views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Good morning and welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, your station for Guardian Smart Talk all day. You will forgive me, I am again flustered this morning. I just spent the last 3 minutes trying to count out 1,000 juju and bag them up. Welcome to On the Clock with Erin Green on this Friday, the 28th of January, 2022. We engage organizations, institutions, social and cultural leaders, and ordinary people to better understand the policy, private sector development, and emerging social and consumer trends. On the Clock, we help understand and navigate a rapidly changing Bahamas. Well, this is another Sports Friday, but we have to keep the sports segment extremely, extremely short today. We don't have enough time to get into it all. I just have to say, though, I have to bring you the results of the greatest sports match that took place this week, Buccaneers versus the... Who beat the Buccaneers? Boy, they beat the Buccaneers so bad. The Bengals, right? Oh, boy. And there was another game. Beat bad. I mean, these were great games. In fact, I watched a game last night. I watched these people beat up on my good Lakers. But that ain't the greatest game in the world. The greatest game that took place is Aaron versus Monkey Tamarin, round two. And let me tell y'all, Erin went into that bush, and she found that mom, and then she ran away, because that's the only way you could beat Monkey Tamarin, is to find it. But I went in that bush. You see, it's the thing about these plants smart. They very, very smart. So as soon as I saw you, there had to have been something else in the bush more valuable than Monkey Tamarin, because Monkey Tamarin is a thing, like the itchiness. That's a protection mechanism. Monkey tamarin becomes itchy and irritant. It becomes an irritant to prevent you from picking it at its most, the most important stage is when it's dropping seeds so it can reed itself, keep itself going. So whenever you see monkey tamarin in the bush, there's two things you have to remember. It's something important in the bush. A, very important. B, stay away from it. You can't beat it or face to face. So I think that was the most exciting game this will have. Eric Sawyer, the third, joining me for our wrap-up and to talk about sports in the country. I'm trying to get the founder of the Bahamas Porking Association to join. Now, look here again. I know you. Pause. I got some special guests in the studio this morning, and I haven't introduced them yet. Are they laughing at me? They don't know that we have an official Porking Association in the Bahamas. Porking is a local game. In fact, we see iterations now showing up at the Olympic level. It says handball, and it's a combination of handball and dodgeball, and don't get bice in your head ball. And so we are taking it seriously. And as the Olympic Association has accepted esports as a new category of competition, we know that they are open to all types of new events. Don't watch nothing. Also, we're going to get back to this story. The Andre Rogers Stadium costs an additional for $2 million. I could build you all a baseball stadium through Johnson Road. I'm just saying. We'll get back to that next week. Again, there's lots to touch on in the news, but really, I cannot. And you will understand once I start my show. I don't really want to talk politics this morning unless it's the politics of local agriculture and regional agriculture. Let's start the show. Let me introduce my guests. I think the conversation is going to be fun, enjoyable, and informative, most of all. Today, joining me in studio are representatives from the International Organization for Migration. That's the IOM. And joining me are, in fact, are the Coordination Officer for the Caribbean and the Program Support Officer for the Caribbean and the Lead Officer at the Bahamas Office of IOM. I'm going to let them introduce themselves as we begin the conversation. We're going to start to my right. Good morning, Ms. Karen Moss-Timothy.
Good morning, and good morning, Erin, and good morning, Bahamas. I'm Karen Moss-Timothy, the head of office for IOM Bahamas.
Erin, good morning. I'd like to thank you, and I'd like to thank Guardian Radio for the opportunity to speak to you this morning and to speak to our listeners in the Bahamas. My name is Robert Natiello. And I work for the International Organization for Migration as the Regional Coordination Officer for the Caribbean and the Chief of Mission in Guyana, so based in Georgetown, but happy to be here in the Bahamas this morning.
Good morning, Erin. Thanks for having us. My name is Brendan Tarnay. I'm a Program Support Officer for the Caribbean, and I'm also based out of Georgetown, Guyana. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely, and it's my pleasure. This is the type of work, this is the types of conversations that I look forward to on the show. But I have a personal reason why I'm here. I am an agricultural advocate, and I have been advocating for years for the free movement of mangoes throughout the Caribbean. This is one of these instances where the Bahamas, although we have every good thing in the world here, we just don't have enough mangoes. And it's a shame that our Caribbean brothers and sisters have so much mango, and we can't figure out how to ensure that these mangoes could move freely. You all don't think the mangoes won't visit the Bahamas? They won't come here too, you know. Anyway, that's my personal agenda in this discussion. But this is an important discussion, I think, for the Bahamas, for the government, for civil society, and for anybody who's concerned about the development of the country. And I want to say to Ms. Timothy Moss, Moss-Timothy, it's great to have you back. You've been working with the UN for approximately 20 years before returning home?
Yes, in New York.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that they let you come back to us.
I'm glad too.
We call that voluntary return, right? And voluntary migration.
Yes.
I'm very happy
that
they let you come back. And that you worked in the Prime Minister's Delivery Unit.
Yeah, a part of the main reason that I came back, that was the time they were establishing the Prime Minister's Delivery Unit. So a key part of my portfolio really was to lead the staffing of that unit and the establishment of it. So that was really the pullback here, and then we transitioned almost like full circle back to the UN.
Absolutely. But that's great because you need to have a degree of institutional knowledge
yes.
to be able to lead
yeah.
an intergovernmental organization and, I guess, maximize its potential in country and in the region. That is awesome.
Definitely.
Glad to have you back.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
So let's get into it. Please, someone tell us, what is the IOM?
You just said it yourself, Erin. The International Organization for Migration is an intergovernmental organization.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? That means that countries are member states of the organization. We are part of the United Nations system as of 2016. Prior to 2016, we were a separate intergovernmental organization.
Okay.
And we joined in a formal way the UN, as I said, at the end of 2016. And they now refer to us as the UN Migration Agency.
Okay.
IOM is committed to the principle that safe, regular, and orderly migration benefits both migrants and societies. And when I say societies, I mean the societies to where those migrants migrate to, but also the societies from whence those migrants migrate.
Yes, absolutely. What I'm just totally excited about is the idea that the IOM didn't come out of the UN, but the IOM came to the UN and said, look, let us assist you and support this work that you're doing, which means that other bodies in a region like the Caribbean could start growing itself to the capacity where it could say, hey, listen, let us join you in developing policy for this region and helping other, maybe small island developing states do the same. This is fantastic.
If I could say something there, you know, I think over the last 10 or 15 years, we have seen the issue of migration grow in globally, mm-hmm. And we've seen the challenges around migration continue to grow. IOM has always worked closely with the United Nations system, so we've always sort of been a partner.
Right.
But as the migration challenges began to increase in different regions of the world, that's when we said we should sort of let's join forces, essentially. Right.
And help, I'm going to say take the lead,
yeah.
But understanding the level of support required to engage these crises, correct. Issues, and develop solutions.
Correct. At the end of 2016, when we joined, the UN General Assembly organized the very first high-level dialogue between member states, among member states, on international migration and refugee protection.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first international dialogue, high-level dialogue, on migration and refugees. And at that point, we joined formally the UN.
Awesome.
And to add to that, too, I think what, you know, we've been talking about the Sustainable Development Goals. And if you look at each of the goals, migration actually is woven through each goal. So you actually can't move forward in terms of development without taking that into consideration.
Sure. Absolutely. And from the... from the Bahamian perspective, a few years ago, I had the opportunity to meet Derek Walcott, you know, and I posed this question, you know, why? Well, more of a comment, in the Bahamian tradition, we don't like to ask questions, we just make comment. Shouldn't the Caribbean nations and a nation like the Bahamas, shouldn't we be sitting at the forefront? Shouldn't we be leading discourse and policy making around migration, given not just our historical engagement, but our practical geographic lived experience, right? We should be informing these discussions. And I hope that Caribbean nations now see the opportunities available for them to engage these discussions at the intergovernmental and supranational level. And so I don't know if you're all ready to sort of jump into my question, but that's one of the things I really wanted to ask.
Yeah.
How many countries have an IOM presence and are working actively with IOM to support regional migration programming?
Yeah. So we have, at this time, we currently have 175 member states. Mm-hmm. I think the UN has 190 member states or 92 member states. When we joined the UN, that did not mean automatically that all of the UN members suddenly were IOM members.
Right.
We still have our members. Our assembly still meets sort of separately from the General Assembly.
Okay.
But we do have a presence, a physical staff presence, in approximately 160 countries.
Wow.
You know, one of the things that you said, Aaron, a minute ago, I think is important for our listeners in the Bahamas and the Caribbean. You know, the Caribbean is a region that's really been formed throughout its history by migration. And migration is an important aspect in socially, politically, demographically. It's really an important issue for the Caribbean. And it's a region that historically has been defined by migration,
mm-hmm.
Whether forced migration or voluntary migration.
Right.
And we come from Guyana, right? Right. I say we come from, but we work in Guyana.
Yeah.
And Guyana is a country that has been formed by migration.
Absolutely.
And in recent history, yeah.
Recent history, migration is, active, but it's a prominent part of the politics, the relationship with Venezuela.
Sure.
The movement of people on their various borders. Mm-hmm. And then they got people like me from the Bahamas who just want to go down there every opportunity I get. And so I wanted to ask this quick question. Do we consider tourism as migration?
You want to take that one?
Migration has usually a pretty specific term in which migration is typically when people move for the purpose of staying for a longer period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Tourism is not considered migration per se, but it is human mobility,
yeah. Right?
And that's super important to take into consideration because you're also talking about foreigners on your soil, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, there are a lot of obligations that countries have to help the people on their soil, just as if they would migrants. But
right.
they are not considered migrants per se because they're not moving for the purpose right. of staying.
I was just thinking about this new policy that has unfolded in the midst of the COVID pandemic, where Caribbean countries have offered sort of long-term residency arrangements for people to come and work in country. And if that would be considered a sort of new form of migration, and can we then say, look, Caribbean people, y'all are actively engaged in creating new migration policies and strategies? So I think a lot of people really appreciated the opportunity to come to the region, to move to the region,
mm-hmm.
and be able to be rooted here, but also have a degree of yeah. entrenchment in their country of origin, not have to give it up.
Yeah.
And for Caribbean people, a lot of Bahamians would love that same similar living, working arrangement if they could go and do a long-term residency in another country, but still be have to give up residency here or become a permanent resident mm-hmm. there. No talk of giving up citizenship. And I think that that's something that our government is actively mm-hmm. engaging and figuring
yeah.
out. How do we support a new type of migration
yeah.
like that while balancing the need to focus on other forms of migration that still need
yeah.
better management?
Yeah.
Sure. There are a lot of forms of migration, and I think you're touching a bit on sort of labor migration.
Yeah.
And labor migration is crucial for societies to meet kind of demographic challenges, labor market gaps.
Yeah.
And we had a meeting with one of the ministers yesterday, and he was saying, well, yes, we often have countries who come and kind of pick our nurses, and they offer right. So then that can create a dearth or a lack
yeah.
of nurses here. So how do we fill that
right.
labor market need? Right. So, migration is necessary to meet labor market demands, to ensure the viability of skills of persons. And there, I think some of the sort of mechanisms or schemes that you mentioned have been with us for a long time. In the United States, we had the Bracero program,
mm-hmm.
And it was bringing, farm workers from Mexico to work in the United States for a period of time. And then, they would go back to
yeah.
Mexico for part of the year. The money that they earned can also assist in their home communities to develop their home communities. I used to work in Colombia. In Colombia, we had a similar program where we would send Colombian migrants to Spain. They would work for 6 to 9 months, then they would come back for a period of time to be with their families. And then, if their contract was renewed, they could go back to Spain. We call those types of programs circular labor migration programs.
Right. And,
and they're effective in many ways.
Yeah. The contract.
I was just going to say, and the question you pose actually touches on how dynamic migration really is, because we in the Bahamas are familiar with this contract. And in our meeting we met yesterday with mm-hmm. the Prime Minister, and this was some of the one of the points we were talking about
mm-hmm.
in terms of we've known this for a while, and I think what's where we are now is really to have this discussion, what migration really is, because here in the Bahamas, I think when we hear migration, we only think of what's being pushed on us, and we don't
right.
really understand that we've been participating in this. Even when you send your children off to college, they are migrating.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you would also like that receiving country to treat your children in a certain way
right.
while they're there. So it's a conversation you should be interested in. And then since Dorian, we've now have a new kind of migration because we have internal migration.
Right.
Because coming from, Harbor Island, where I grew up cracking rocks barefoot, it's a whole different experience from Nassau. And when you move to Nassau, because
mm-hmm.
when you can get that baked hot bread with some butter and lemonade, it's different when you
fresh.
Have to just go into the store for that thing. So you know what that's like.
Fresh key lime is a migration. And
mm-hmm.
being in Nassau and being so far removed
yeah.
from going out to the tree and picking the key lime and just making the switcher.
Exactly.
And for Bahamians to understand, that, yeah, that's the same experience.
Exactly.
When you're talking to your brother and he in college,
yep,
and he's there crying because you're all charming him with the bump, with the thing, with the chicken in the bag, right? But it's the same thing when your cousins are in Nassau and you sitting home on the island saying, why they crying? They in Nassau, and they're like, but we miss home so much. And there was a, if I could just add before we go on, there, if the public remembers, there's a story in the media recently, unfortunately, it was a tragic story, mm-hmm, where a young Bahamian man, who I think was on a labor migration program, mm-hmm, was killed in Florida.
Wow.
And it turns out he was working in a company with a number of Bahamians.
Mm-hmm.
But the attention that was paid to the story, then when you're reading the story, you understand the obligations that the employers had, the expectation,
yes,
of care, right? And this is because there are migration policies.
Yes.
There's a culture of migration and understanding the rights,
yes,
and duties connected to it. And Bahamians, again, when we think about it, we're familiar,
yes,
with these things.
Yep. The conversation is necessary. I mean, if we haven't seen anything over the last 2 years with the pandemic, you recognize that, you know, somebody on the left sneezes or on the other side of the river sneezes, we catch the cold. So this is why we need to actually have these kind of painful dialogues. But I think sometimes we're afraid of things because we don't know about them. But once we get to break it down and know it and become familiar with it, you know, I mean, I'm sure you maybe remember, you can remember when you first learning how to drive. It's terrifying. But once you understood the mechanisms,
mm-hmm,
of it, you can do it almost subconsciously now. So I think that's what's important for shows like your show and, you know, engaging civic society, because what we've seen over this last week in meeting with the ministers of the government, they get it. They understand it. They know that they've gone into the international arena. They've signed some treaties. And sometimes it's the challenge of breaking that down into the language of the everyday person, because on the left, they're thinking my constituent and what they want to hear and what I'm supposed to tell them, whereby it will take civil society who would have these real life experiences. We need the mothers and fathers who are sending their children off to come to the table and have this dialogue. Because if we can start the conversation with policy, then we can understand when it's being discussed globally what the discussion is about. And when we send our prime minister, like we did to COP26, and he's speaking on our behalf, then we know he's speaking for us. There's a,
mm-hmm,
meeting coming up, and I believe Robert can explain a little bit more about that in terms of the UN in May, and the prime minister may go there and speak for the Bahamas on migration. So it's important that when he's representing the country, but you can only do that when there is that full understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something we should stop being afraid of.
Right, absolutely. We should and start actively engaging,
yeah,
in. Because then we will realize that sometimes our fears are misplaced.
Yeah.
We often think that the migration and the government and these activists, they only focus on helping,
yeah,
these other people,
yeah,
from other countries,
mm-hmm,
and not us,
mm-hmm,
but not understanding that the work that you do is also focused on creating conditions in country where,
yes,
people are more likely to stay.
Mm-hmm.
Responding to crises and providing solutions, particularly for natural disasters, to assist people staying and reducing the need.
Yes.
No, it's because sometimes we talk about the people's desire to leave and live a better life, and we don't often talk about the urgent need to relocate.
Yes.
But I think the climate change intersection with migration is,
mm-hmm,
an aspect that could possibly open that up. So if we have an opportunity to talk about it,
mm-hmm,
but I'm very interested in this meeting. It's a COP meeting, right?
Karen mentioned the Conference,
yeah,
of the Parties. That's the global climate change
meeting that
takes place.
Absolutely.
But then there's a meeting that comes up later this year. It's in May, actually.
Right.
And it's what we call the International Migration Review Forum, because in 2018, member states of the UN signed a compact called the Global Compact,
okay,
on Migration. And this is, yeah, this is very much sort of the global international level. But there's a recognition that, in order for us to be able to address some of the challenges which are, you know, posed by migration. States need to come together to discuss how we work together to address these challenges.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. IOM often says that, you know, migration is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
It's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's desirable.
Mm-hmm.
We use those three words. Migration is inevitable, necessary, and desirable. It's inevitable because of demographic factors, economic factors, environmental factors, which you just mentioned, global climate change and migration, right? And we've seen it here in the Bahamas. It's necessary, as I said earlier, to meet labor demands and to ensure the viability and the availability of skills, the vibrancy of economies. Migrants contribute to economies, whether they are in the receptor community, right, in the country of destination, and also in their own home countries. They also contribute to the vibrancy of local economies. And it's desirable for migrants and for host populations alike. And as you said a few minutes ago, Aaron, you know, there's a desire for people like, hey, I want to go migrate. I want to go here and I want to go there. I mean, it's part of human nature. Migration has always been with us. It's always been, and it always will be with us.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we manage it properly? And that's the discussion that we need to have. We used to have a director general who would say, migration is not a problem to be solved. It's a reality to be managed.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It will always be with us. So how do we kind of manage migration properly through these policies, through these programs, in order to sort of minimize some of these, and there are negative aspects to migration, right? There are challenges and difficulties posed by migration.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we manage them to minimize those difficulties, those challenges, those problems? And how do we maximize the development potential which migration can offer? Karen made reference to the Sustainable Development Goals earlier. Prior to the Sustainable Development Goals, we had the Millennial Development Goals.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no mention of migration in the Millennium Development Goals. But I think the international community started to see it like, wait a second, you know, migration can contribute to development processes.
Oh, yeah.
And so... Mm-hmm. So let's include migration in the Sustainable Development.
You know, I would say to my audience, the story I tell this morning about me and the monkey tamarind and the wild passion fruit, that's a story of migration, right? But the entire Bahamian story is a story of migration. And not the heavy imperialist part y'all think I'm talking about, right? But crack conch is a Greek invention. Yeah. Right?
We love crack conch.
And then you can't tell Bahamians that crack conch ain't Bahamian. The conch itself, as it migrates through the Caribbean, right?
Yeah.
As it moves to Haiti, you gotta eat conch the way they eat it in Haiti.
Yeah.
When you in Haiti. And when you in, look here, when you in Barbados, you gotta eat conch the way they eat it in Barbados.
Yeah.
And it's you know, such a beautiful story. At the same time, it's so important for Bahamians to understand policy, understand the culture of migration, the culture of migration management in the region. I see you want
to... Yeah. You mentioned something a few minutes ago, Aaron, that I also wanted to touch on. And you talked about sort of... one of the things that we talk about in IOM is addressing the drivers of migration.
Yeah.
What drives, what forces people to migrate?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of different types of drivers. Perhaps it's sort of poor governance, and you know, there's no rule of law. Areas are controlled by gangs.
Mm-hmm.
People have to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Their safety is in danger, right?
Mm-hmm.
We talked about climate change, hurricanes, earthquakes, volcanoes. People have to move.
Yeah.
These are the drivers of migration, and also lack of economic opportunity. So as you said, Aaron, we do work in an area that we call community stabilization, where we're trying to provide opportunities for people so that they don't feel like they have to migrate. They have access to a job, they can make an income, and they can take care of themselves and their families.
Yeah.
So in the countries where we are working on community stabilization to sort of prevent migration, especially irregular migration.
Mm-hmm.
And when people migrate, how do we protect the dignity of those persons?
Mm-hmm.
How do we protect the rights of those persons? How do we make sure that their basic needs are met?
Producer, let's go to a break, and when we come back from the break, I'm going to tell you all a story about just about that, right? I had a... let me go into the break. I had an incident where I was stopped by customs and immigration in the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. It was an eye opener, mm-hmm. but it required a bit of empathy and mindfulness and spatial awareness, understanding where I was to really get a sense of why I was experiencing mm-hmm. what mm-hmm. I was experiencing. So, producer, let's go to this break, and when we get back from this break, we're going to continue this insightful, informative conversation with the representatives from the International Organization of Migration. You're on the clock with Erin Green. Stay tuned to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. We'll be right back.
Like what you're hearing on the show? Want to support the conversation? Sponsor On the Clock today. Call Janet Lees at 302-2304. That's 302-2304. Be the solution. Sponsor On the Clock with Erin Green, where she dissects, we discuss, and you decide.
Ready to save? You can put $100 into the CFAL Savings Express plan and make sure your money keeps growing. Earn interest on your savings while you're sleeping, eating, or standing in line at the bank. Ready to invest? Start by putting $1,000 into our mutual funds and earn interest there too. Because at CFAL, your interest is our interest. Visit CFAL.com to start now. CFAL. Growing wealth for future generations of Bahamians.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.
Good morning, good yawning this morning, and welcome back to On the Clock with Erin Green. You're tuned into Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, and I have representatives from the International Organization for Migration with me this morning, entertaining my questions about the free movement of mangoes. If we are going to implement a regional sun visa, you got to get a visa to migrate to the Bahamas. I mean, when you have something of value, you have to figure out how to capitalize on it. And I want to know, would it be fair to create a policy that non-resident migrants to the Bahamas or to the Caribbean have to pay a special tax? Would it be discrimination to tell them they have to pay extra to experience this Bahamian, this good Caribbean sun? Or is this not in the making of good regional and international relations? Is this discrimination? Erin, you can't do it. You can't hog up the sun and tell people if they want to migrate here, they got to pay extra money. Are we allowed to do that? Could we create a sun tax?
I like that. I like the idea, actually. You know, we often talk about, states are sovereign entities.
Mm-hmm.
And states have the right to determine who enters their country, how they enter their country,
mm-hmm.
how long they stay in their country, and how they leave their country, mm-hmm. essentially, right? So we don't necessarily, IOM walks a bit of a delicate line
okay.
between protecting the rights of migrants, but also recognizing the sovereignty of states.
And the citizens that they represent,
and
right?
And the citizens that yeah. they represent, of course. And that's part of the sovereignty of those states.
Because when you look at it it's a government thing, then you an advocate like me will be like, oh well, I'm an anti-imperialist. I don't have time for that. But when you see that it's the power vested in the citizens, right, and it is their right to define their environment, mm-hmm. and so it's not a matter of the government don't have nothing to say. It's a matter of how does the government facilitate the defining of our identity and what that identity is. And I find that when you then shift the conversation, those very same people mm-hmm. are far more willing to engage migration than we assume that they are.
Yeah.
But don't worry, my people, I'm not the government yet. There's no sun tax. However, would a sun tax be a great way to fund the work of the IOM, of in-country groups doing migration work, and the support services that IOM and other organizations offer? For instance, there is a Bahamian man, I won't call his name for sake of privacy, who was a part of a reintegration process facilitated by IOM, International and Bahamian branches. And so he had been, he's born here, taken to the States by his parents at about 8. That's that involuntary migration people. He didn't have a choice. Yeah. He had to go where his parents take him, but was returned home involuntary after a case. IOM was able to support his reintegration, assist in temporary housing, assist in finding work, and then a small grant to start a business. Mm-hmm. So how do we fund these types of initiatives, and how do we ensure, well, how can civil society organizations create sustainable programs like that to support that work?
Yeah. Actually, Robert will explain on that more, but it just reminded me, too, the reason IOM in 2010, we actually first came to the Bahamas to help Bahamians who were deported from the U.S. To reintegrate back into society.
That's awesome. And at the same time, gentlemen, don't mind me running on with all these questions. You know, y'all are the experts. Lead me where we're supposed to go. As a woman, I like talking about money, but we don't have to talk about that. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. No problem. Reintegration is a really interesting topic, and it is a great need. And Caribbean states have asked for support in it, and Caribbean states want to work together for it. In fact, CARICOM works a lot in reintegration, and it's important to set up these mechanisms, right? Where, you know, if you do have somebody forcibly returned to the Bahamas, it's not just government's role. Civil society plays a wonderful role in it. You know, and you know, when somebody arrives and they have a particular need, there does need to be a referral mechanism upon arrival, right?
Yeah.
And it does take some coordination, it does take some work, and there are civil society organizations that are ready and willing to do so. Now, fostering that, of course, is really the work of the people to really service their citizens who are returning, and recognizing also that their citizens returning are in a vulnerable state, especially if they've never really spent their lives here, don't have that network supporting them. And IOM often supports these types of programs.
Yeah.
I'd also like to note that, you know, a lot of people are returned for, you know, having broken the law in another country. I'm not just in the United States. It happens in within CARICOM itself.
Yeah.
You know, a Bahamian in Jamaica may be forcibly removed from Jamaica.
And just a point, not even breaking the law, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm undocumented. I'm living here irregularly. That put that aside.
Yeah.
I'm a model citizen. Mm-hmm. Nobody even knows that I'm not supposed to be here. I'm just on the scene of an accident and the police insist that I become a witness.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden I'm on a plane heading back to
the
Bahamas.
And you can see the fear of why people don't come forward if they are undocumented, right? And that is a challenge. But it is important for also the local citizenry wherever in the world to know that, you know, not everybody being returned needs to be feared or as a criminal. You know, everybody wants to contribute to society, and it really is kind of the obligation and role of society and civil society and government to facilitate that access, because no one wants to end up in a worse situation than they were before.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also right now, beginning last year, under the Western Hemisphere Program, which Brandon's coordinator for in this region, we have the MyGap, which is a migration app, and we're intending to expand that further. We have a meeting today with the Minister of Tourism as well, because we also have a training for persons working in the tourism industry for the trafficking of persons. We also have the intention to expand on the information hub, which we think integrated into tourism can benefit locally as well as for migrants. But another major achievement, a milestone that we'd like to achieve, is having the course implemented through the University of the Bahamas. And we've had dialogues and meetings with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Immigration. And what persons should understand, too, even without us having controlled and programmed meetings, IOM has a plethora of courses, e-courses, that the general public can actually go to our website, learn about migration, get certificates for that, and really develop your understanding of migration, and also then you're more able to participate in the policy-making process.
Yeah. Hold on. So two things. Look at show number 2. how y'all going to have to come here and talk to us about all these e-courses. Because I was 14 years old,
right?
When I was moving through the Hartsfield Airport in Atlanta and realized the extent to which they focused on awareness around human smuggling and human trafficking in every women's bathroom, two to three placards with various sources of who to call, what to look out for. Yeah. And how could we in the Bahamas not have seen the need for that? But I will say that particularly post-Dorian, we saw a focus on the need to manage migration for various reasons, for the proper management and supervision of environmental resources and the illegal movement of animals, smuggling of animals, particular focus on the risk of the... of smuggling and trafficking of minor children for various reasons. And so that's a
show too.
I mean, gosh, no. And it should be a part of the hotel and tourism training syllabuses, right? Sure. Like this is, and I'm going to just put in a plug here for the Bahamas. Maybe the Bahamas can begin to lead the conversation at the academic level and the advocacy level on this.
Actually, on that point, too, we had a very great meeting with the Ministry of Social Services. Their team was quite impressive. They prepared for the meeting with us. They actually proved that the information that we have on the website can be pulled down, reviewed, and put together. And we're looking forward to a great team work with them, including the Ministry of Health team and the Ministry of Immigration, because they have the understanding and proving, again, this whole concept of the whole of governance approach to migration, which basically can then bring it into the public for us to, you know, have an understanding of it and move it forward.
Absolutely. If I could build on what Karen just said, and I was sort of looking for the opportunity to duck in, Karen just used really a key phrase, and I was going to build on what Brendan said, because Brendan talked a lot about kind of how civil society can support, and not just sort of formal civil society organizations, but our friends and our neighbors. You know, in Guyana, when we have a person who's been deported, there's often a lot of suspicion of that person. That person can't get a job. And, you know, that person's just, like, trying to survive, right? But because he or she's been deported, there's a lot of discrimination. The other thing I wanted to say very briefly is that IOM believes that migration, adequate and proper migration management, requires a whole-of-government approach, because many ministries and many agencies and departments within the government, whether they know it or not, their work and their portfolio touches in one way or another on migration. And it's the same with a whole-of-society approach. IOM doesn't believe that we are the only agency that can address migration, and just the Ministry of Immigration and Labor or the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, they're the ones who handle migration. There has to be a dialogue among all stakeholders, and all of us are stakeholders in this issue of migration.
And a cultural appreciation. For how it operates, what it thinks to look like. I'm known to be a sort of a busybody and not minding my business. And sometimes I have to say to the public, look here, there are some things that we are not going to mind our business on. There are things that we allow adults to do, grown adults. But if, like yesterday, I'm driving on Abundant Life Road, I just want a young boy in that van to understand this, and you are holding up traffic because you trolling a young girl. It could have been a woman, but she looked like a child. And you holding up traffic, following her in your van. People like me are paying attention, because that is a sign, an indicator of possible human and trafficking. You could snatch her and put her in that van the same way you could snatch these little children and put them in the van. So when y'all see big people looking at y'all like, why are y'all chatting up these little children and staring you down? If you're not into something nefarious, or you shouldn't be doing, you just look and you smile and you say, oh, hey, mom, no, everything cool. And press gas and keep going, because you realize that your behavior was inappropriate and your negative response to it. See, this is it here. When you then turn around and cuss people for doing what they ought to do, then they stop doing what they ought to do. And that's what we ought to be doing. You know, historically and culturally, we're in a place where you peep some, you keep some. You don't talk everything you see. But that is one of the things that we have to pay attention to, because we do have an issue with human trafficking, child trafficking, and sex trafficking in this town. Right? And so culturally, this is these are the ways that we raise a society that can understand its role, right? And find cultural ways to respond. Yeah. So we understand that young people are naturally sexual beings and they could flirt and they could talk. But then young people also understand that there are elders in the community that will always have an eye open. And not to fight them, but to understand why these environments exist. Not just for you, but for the protection of everybody. And I think post-Dorian, that became most prominent when people were like, hey, but these people are coming to help. And other people were like, but hey, we need to make sure that children are protected. Absolutely. But I run on, my guests. I do have a question if you guys don't have a question. Climate change and involuntary migration. So I guess the first real question is, where can people and organizations who are interested in supporting this particular work, development of strategies, policies, and management of migration and involuntary migration with the increase of natural disasters in the region, volcanoes, hurricanes, rising sea levels?
Yeah, this is you know, this is an area that has grown for IOM in the last, I'll say, 10 years. And we established a migration, environment, and climate change unit in our headquarters. And this is an area that we're looking at more and more closely because we recognize that there are already in place and there have already existed, you know, a number of sort of mass movements of persons because of climate change and natural disasters. We sort of separate into what we call sudden onset disasters or slow onset disasters. An example of a slow onset disaster, of course, is drought. And we've seen people who are sort of running out of water in their region. They can't grow their crops and they have to move. Sea level rise is another sort of slow onset disaster. We're seeing it in the South Pacific Islands. Caribbean states are likely to be affected by this, if not already, then in the coming years. And then the sudden onset disasters certainly are those really intense tropical storms and hurricanes, which we've seen growing both in frequency and in ferocity. You know, there are policies to sort of plan how we move, how we prepare for storms. And there's sort of a whole field of work around disaster risk reduction and planned evacuation of communities and persons. And this is some of the work that's been done in Brendan's program, you know, developing some studies.
Yeah, we just have we just published one study on planned. It's called "Finding Higher Ground: Planned Relocation in the Caribbean," and it addresses several case studies of where governments or communities themselves have relocated their entire communities to safer areas to get out of harm's way, right? And that's planned relocation, right? And this is going to be happening more and more. As a matter of fact, People themselves, not government, implemented by government, but families are already considering, where am I going to move? Where am I going to move my family? And this really important subject area, and it's happening on all of the islands, especially low-lying areas.
Yes. In fact, I wish we had had this conversation yesterday or a couple of days before the local government elections, right? Because it would have been great if voters could have sort of engaged issues like these and just said, listen, are you interested? Have you thought about this? Can you help us begin doing the work ourselves in case we have to make this shift? I think lots of family islanders are, let me rephrase that. It's obvious that family islanders are already engaging these issues without the support of the state or civil society. through the massive relocation of people to New Providence.
Yeah. Actually, even on that note, too, we actually had a meeting with the Deputy Speaker, Mr. Honorable Sylvanus Petty, mm-hmm. who's also the representative for Eleuthera. And that's actually the kind of thinking he has already in terms of engaging with IOM, because he wants to, he's considering where can we build a shelter not just for housing people, but a shelter that we have the supplies there in place before we need them so that we have a rapid response. And this is the kind of thinking we need from above as well as from the ground up.
Right. I mean, I will say the work of advocates and then the work of sort of media personalities
yes.
is to build and grow a culture of appreciation for the work that is taking place. We're almost out of time. I just want another quick question. And the intersection of COVID and migration and the movement of documented and undocumented migrants or irregular and regular migration, can civil society organizations that want to that are interested in this work, can they partner with or find resources through IOM to provide multi-language messaging for PSAs and public messaging around COVID? And then a last question, I know we don't have time, but maybe you can send me a link. Are there examples of countries in the region that are administering vaccines to undocumented migrants, right? They sort of adopted a policy, whether formally or informally, of the need to mitigate the spread by sure. maximizing vaccine in uptake. Sure. Are there any examples? Yeah.
IOM, I'll answer the second part first, yeah. Aaron. The issue of vaccinations, you know, until all of us are safe, none of us are safe. So we advocate with governments to include migrants, including undocumented migrants, to have access to vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we have a segment of the population, the undocumented migrants, unvaccinated, we're putting our own population at risk. I think the Bahamas has done a pretty good job at including irregular migrants in vaccination. Oftentimes, as Brendan said mm-hmm. earlier, there's some hesitancy and some fear for an undocumented migrant to seek services.
Mm-hmm.
And what we need to do is kind of ensure persons that they have a right to a vaccination, mm-hmm. and they can access the vaccination process in order to ensure the safety of our entire mm-hmm. populations. The other part of the question I wanted to answer, and I've
that was on providing how civil society can provide.
Does IOM provide opportunities or access to technical capacity building to provide multi-language messaging for COVID PSAs?
Yes, we do. We've done that. We've done it in Guyana. We've done it in Spanish. We've done it in Haitian Creole for the Venezuelan, the Cuban, the Haitian community in Guyana. We do it all over the world.
Dominica did it in Chinese and Spanish,
yeah,
and Haitian
correct,
Creole. Yeah,
correct. I think even in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
Yes,
in the Bahamas,
we
had
did.
Some programs where we yeah. did in different languages as well.
Absolutely. And look how we're going to get the Ministry of Tourism on board because we have
them.
Multi-language guests coming in mm-hmm. all the time, and
yeah.
that can
yeah.
spur a trickle down to our undocumented and migrant communities, less visible
yeah.
communities.
You know, as I said earlier, yeah. just on the very quickly, we
yeah.
believe that we all need to work together on
yeah.
migration challenges. We don't actually provide funding necessarily for civil society organizations because
okay.
we're not a donor organization,
okay.
but we partner with civil society organizations in our projects, and then there is obviously opportunity to sort of distribute, share our funding with our partners, right?
Right,
yeah.
right.
But we don't donate funds to civil society
right.
organizations. We work with them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, a good example of that, too, we've been in one of our projects with the Bahamas Psychological Association. Mm-hmm. We've just, with linking them with the donor, we're implementing right now with them on mental health care.
Right.
So I think, and they've got a pretty good grant from that donor, and it's actually going to service a number of the family islands as well.
Absolutely.
And we work with a number of community-based organizations
yes.
here in the Bahamas
Absolutely.
As well.
And Abaco, on Abaco and Eleuthera as well. And this, again, brings home that point of why we should organize ourselves. And one of the hopes and visions is that after this process, this is almost like the jump off,
right.
Really, we can then go to the next step of coming together as an interagency plus civil society network where we can have these dialogues and out of those dialogues begin to not only train individuals on how to put together your concept notes, how to put together the programs, so then we then become your help in this, just like we're helping government, we're helping society, because we then become that mediator between where the donors may be, what they're interested in, and what you need. And that's really what we hope to do here.
Absolutely. Thank you so very much. And so NGOs and civil society, this speaks to the importance of registering under the MPO Act,
yes.
So that you can work with organizations like IOM who can direct you to available funding if you qualify, if you fit the criteria. Also, the IOM is going to help me relocate. I bleed
mango.
Listen, I bleed mango, and I see in the future maybe a possible devastation of mangoes. And so I'm beginning my planned migration to a place where thousands of mango trees live. If I can't force migration of mango trees to the Bahamas, one of these will work. Anyway, I'd like to thank you so very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
IOM, Mr. Natiello, Mr. Tarnay, and Ms. Moss Timothy.
Thank you.
I want you all in the audience to know I'm running out of time, but I will never run out of juju, and I got some to share with my guests today. They're going to get a good Bahamian gift of juju, tamarind ball, and star fruit lemonade. All them fruits migrate from the island to New Providence for this joyous occasion. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for staying tuned. Levon Miller is up next. You guys have a great day and a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.